This week on the Barak World Show, we have talks about why you should love designing emails and an unusual way to get clients thinking about design. This week's show is sponsored by FreshBooks and Full Story. Hello and welcome to the Barak World Show, the podcast about all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name is Paul Barak. Joining me on this week's show, as always, is Marcus. But we also, very exciting, we also have Lee on the show. We haven't had him on for a while. Hello, Lee.
I think you overbilled me there a little bit.
No, but you were on last week's show.
Oh, we saw
it. No. Yeah.
I thought you were having a Lee special and having two in one.
No.
God.
That would be too much, Lee.
I was waiting for the feet
nice
to come through as the Lee special.
Lee.
Yeah, I was going to say, in so many ways, that would be too much.
Fair enough.
How are you, Paul?
Depressed.
Oh,
well, I've just... Don't you feel like... I've just reached this point where I'm fed up with the world. It's all just...
There's no point carrying on. Let's just... walk out into the sea like Reggie Perrin.
Yeah. I mean, don't you think, mine? It's just...
What's the point?
Is it just this time of the week?
We've got Nazis and we've got everything. Everything
but that's
is miserable.
A reason. The Nazis are a reason to stay alive and do something about it. There you go.
Well, Christmas was telling me about the super volcano in Naples.
Oh, yeah.
That looks depressing as well. Yeah. Massive explosion and day turning to night for years.
10 years of night. Yeah.
On the upside, Lee, if the massive super volcano blows up, then that'll deal with the Nazis.
This is true. And we'll have nice sunsets as well, I think. That's always pretty.
I don't actually think that's true, Paul, what you just said.
Are they in Naples? Is that what you're saying?
They're not all in Naples.
Oh, I thought you were talking about Yellowstone. I thought that's due to go as well.
Oh.
No.
Different calamity.
There is a super volcano, of which Krakatoa wasn't one, they've had an earthquake under the sea outside Naples, where the super volcano is underneath, which they think will make it come awake.
Oh,
Yellowstone,
good.
Yellowstone is another one. Yeah,
this is
a really massive, massive one. Like that only happens every 100,000 years.
Yeah, Yellowstone is one.
Yellowstone
of those.
Is bigger.
Really?
It's hundreds of miles
slap bang
across.
In the middle of America.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's due to go. They're all due to go.
This is exciting, isn't it?
Should we do this podcast or
let's talk about really depressing things. I banged my shin really badly.
What's
this
the
morning,
point?
That wasn't nice.
Yeah, but that's not depressing as in the kind of depression you get on Twitter. Because there's a certain type of I don't imagine your shin getting banged going viral on Twitter while neo-Nazi rallies and all of that kind of... I've now had to add so many filters on Twitter to remove keywords, and I've had to unfollow so many people that I don't know why I bother being on it anymore.
Well, isn't it funny? A friend of mine, he's a friend of mine, but he moved to Spain 10 years ago. Mm. He's 66 today.
Mm.
And he said... it's my annual bash onto Facebook. Thanks, everyone, for wishing me a happy birthday, but I don't really do social media anymore.
Mm.
And I thought, I don't much either.
No.
I do it less and less and less
me
and
too,
less.
Yeah.
I think we've discussed this on podcasts in the past, but I don't really know why. Because it's not like anything is less
interesting.
Because
it's depressing.
Do you think that's what it is, Paul?
Seriously, Twitter now... And Andy Budd recently posted on Twitter. I miss the days where we talked about breakfast on Twitter and what we're eating.
People far apart posted what they were having for breakfast or something like that.
But now you'd be criticised from every corner.
I replied to it and said, I absolutely agree. Those were the good old days. And then immediately somebody told me off for being privileged.
Privileged, yes. Well, you are privileged, Paul.
Oh, well,
you
I am
are, actually. Yes, yeah, you
yeah.
are.
Yeah, yeah.
As am I.
Yeah, I am. But I don't see quite how me wanting to talk about breakfast is privileged. But anyway, so yeah, that about sums it up. Really, I want I need to know what's going on in the world, but I don't really want to know it from Twitter. I'd prefer to know it from the BBC.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
I believe the BBC. Do you see what I mean?
So do I, and that's where I get my news from mostly.
Hmm.
So not I think, all, but mostly.
Seeing random people ranting about various subjects doesn't, because I don't know whether I believe them or not, because they're random people. They're not, grown-ups. I'm sounding old, aren't I? I want fact checks.
I think you're kind of, you've been through it. I think all the surprises have gone as well from things like Twitter. We went through all that. We know what it's going to deliver us now from a day on a daily basis. And there are better places to get the stuff that we actually are interested in now.
Yeah.
Feedly and,
That's true, Feedly.
Apple
great.
News, I guess, on the iPad and things.
The only social media I do is Facebook now, and that's not very often either, because that's friends.
Mm.
It's a closed group of mates.
Yeah.
Showing pictures when they're, going out with their family or being silly or whatever, and that's fine. But yeah, Twitter is too much for me, mostly.
Instagram became my happy place for a while. Because that's all people being happy, isn't it? Oh, look, I'm having I'm in beautiful scenery and all of this.
They're privileged lives.
Yeah, exactly. And so I liked that. But then people have started posting social commentary. It's social commentary I don't really like. I think on social media personally, I have no problem with other people can post whatever they want to social media. That's entirely up to them.
Depends. I post some social commentary like Frankie Boyle and Jonathan Pye. He's great.
Oh, Jonathan Pye's awesome. Everything. Yeah, I would vote for him to be Prime Minister.
So there you go. So that is social commentary, Paul.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm fine with that. But just for me, I don't want it via social media.
No, he's on my subscriptions on my YouTube.
Exactly.
So I just go there. Exactly. And that's another stream of stuff that I've decided I like and don't have to be fed.
I want to have my worldview constantly reinforced.
We want to reinforce our bubbles. That's it. We don't want all this outside stuff getting in. People commenting you. And.
Yeah, I don't want,
saying we're
I don't
wrong.
Want contrary views to my own.
I have another theme that we could move to, Paul, because I noticed on Twitter the other day, Paul, that you want a new book to read.
Oh, yes, I do, actually. So I've been reading, obviously, Ian Banks, who I love.
Yes.
Ian M. Banks and The Culture. I love these sci-fi books where you have, kind of complete positive views of the future, actually, if you think about it, rather than the negativity we're living in at the moment. So you've got like The Culture, which is this beautiful utopian wonderful world where computers run everything, which probably isn't a bad idea at this point. It can't be any worse than what we've currently got running things. And then Peter F. Hamilton, where you've got the Commonwealth and again these post economic post capitalist worlds, utopia, Star Trek-y type worlds, and I'm looking for a new one.
Well, Alistair Reynolds definitely is where you need to go next. He wrote a whole bunch of books the human universe, but in hundreds and possibly thousands of years in the future.
Okay. Which one do I start with? Because I read one of his, Chasm, was it Chasm something?
Chasm City is one of them, yes.
Yeah, it didn't really grab me for some reason, but...
Right, well, I'll tell you where you should start, Paul.
Yes, boss.
I should have done this beforehand.
You are my go-to... Sorry, what did you say?
Oh, you're all going a bit crackly there, Paul. Revelation Space, that's where you need to start.
I'm pretty sure I've read that.
Right. Well, it will tell you what the next... There's three of them. And then there are other stories within that sphere. But...
Okay.
Another book that Lee's also reading at the moment.
I'm ahead of you now. Because I listen to them, which is faster.
You can't be ahead of me.
I'm halfway through.
Oh, no, I'm about 85% through.
Oh, right, okay. I'm not ahead of you.
This is a non-fiction book, Paul, about science. And it's called The Things We Cannot Know by a chap called Marcus du Sautoy, who is like the science version of the poet laureate, as far as I can gather.
Yes.
And it's basically every major sciencey thing ever explained in a way that isn't kind of childish, but is understandable mostly. And it's bloody fabulous.
There were a few equations.
Yeah, there are a few equations, but you can just skip over those. That's fine.
They don't go so well on an audiobook.
No, they don't go so well when you can see them either. But it's just, it's, you know, from the early days of science, you know, starting with Newton and things like that, and then on to quantum mechanics and relativity and all that kind of stuff. Things that you think you know about, but actually you haven't got a bloody clue. And it's a really, really good book.
Do you know what? I'm really sorry to break it to you, but there is no way on earth I'm going to read that. And the problem that I have is not that I'm not interested. I'm utterly interested and fascinated by all that kind of stuff. The reason I'm not going to read it is because I have an on tap, constant, never shuts the bloody hell up source of that in my son.
Yeah.
If one more person explains quantum mechanics to me, I think I might have to punch them.
But if anyone, I think, well, it's in the book, it's quoted, if you think you know it, then you don't.
Mm.
Oh, no, James says that, but it doesn't stop him constantly trying to explain it to me, which is even more annoying. On one hand, he says, you know, nobody who says they understand quantum mechanics does. And then on the next hand, spends 3 hours explaining it to me while I'm trapped in a car travelling somewhere with him. You know, that's not nice. That's just cruel.
Let's not get into it. But it's just, I mean, we're not here, really.
No, I know we're not.
None of this is real.
So I don't know. So really, I don't know why anybody cares about this podcast or neo-Nazis. Really, I can't believe I just said neo-Nazis and this podcast in the same breath as if they're interchangeable. That worries me.
There's nothing I can add to that, Paul.
No, there's not, is there, really?
Do you have show titles? Because that sounds like a good one.
That would be great.
Marcus, can you tell Lee that I just can't hear him anymore? He's getting fainter and fainter and disappearing into the distance. Hello, Lee, are you there?
Just talk loudly, Lee.
I'm trying. I think your audio setup's got a bit of a problem, Marcus, because I'm really loud in my ears.
You are in mine too.
Mm. Yeah, it's just me. Perhaps I'm going deaf.
Ooh, I wonder if it could be this. Goes off and does something ticky. You carry on, Paul.
Right, actually, that works well, because I've got to talk about a sponsor. And you can fiddle with things. You can fiddle with your knobs in the meantime. Yeah, how old are you? You should be beyond that, Marcus. Come on, mate. Come on, you're better than that. Right. Okay, let's talk about Full Story, because I'm sure they'd love to be associated with Marcus's knobs. So, Full Story, you know I love Full Story. The next generation of analytics, get rid of Google Analytics, it just annoys me. Doesn't work. I know a lot of people are really into it, but I'm not. I don't understand it. It's too complicated. So in my opinion, Full Story is just the best analytics tool I've ever seen. You put in one little script onto your website and you're done. You never have to create event handlers or manual tagging or any of that kind of stuff. So you can be up and running in minutes. Probably its biggest differentiator from its competition is that every event, every click, every swipe, every scroll, every bit of text is fully and instantly indexed and searchable. So Full Story does no sampling. It just grabs absolutely everything, every single user session, and will give you really detailed insights into user behavior on your site, how people are interacting with every single element. And you can do things retrospectively, look retrospectively at stuff. So once that bit of code is on your website, there's nothing to stop you going back and saying, I wonder how somebody interacts with this element on the page, even though you haven't created any kind of event handler or anything on it. It's just absolutely great. Do you know what? Instead of me talking about how great it is, just go and try it for yourself. You can get a month for free of their pro account. You don't have to enter any credit card. When you get to the end of the month, it will just carry on for free But after the initial month, it's only going to record 1,000 user sessions per month. And then at any stage, when, like me, you get the jitters because you've got withdrawal system symptoms from not having the whole site fully indexed the entire time, then they'll get your money because you'll want to pay for it. It's not cheap, I'll be honest. It's something for reasonable size organizations. If you work in-house, really, you've got to have something like this. But the rest of us can make use of their free account, which is really cool. You can find out all about it at fullstory.com/BOAG, B-O-A-G. Okay, so we come on to our first talk of the day, which is a talk by Laura Harrison. At 1973online.co.uk, which makes her 1 year younger than me, if that's her birthday.
So I can't believe people using their date of birth in their URLs and their Twitter handles. It's just unbelievable.
It's one bit of security gone, isn't it?
I just can't believe it.
I know, right? So
it's too late now, I've done it.
Yes.
Yeah, you don't know. 1970, she looks, from her profile picture, she looks too young to be 1973, so perhaps it references something else, but that might just be because I've aged badly and she hasn't, so compared to me she looks young.
Could be.
Anyway, hello Laura. So Laura works as in digital design. She's been working it for over 13 years and heads up a design and marketing company, and is the creative director of 1973. So creative director makes it sound like she didn't found it. So perhaps it is somebody else. I was going to say. They're a digital agency in Oxfordshire, specializing in design production and automation of global marketing campaigns. So in other words, she does a lot of email design, amongst other things. And I have to say, this is an absolutely brilliant talk that she's got on 5 reasons to love email design and development. And when I saw that talk, I thought, wow, you've got a bit of a challenge ahead of you there, Laura, but she does a stunning job. So let's listen to what Laura's got to say now.
Hi, everyone. I'm Laura, and I'm going to talk to you about the dreaded topic of email design and development. Now, I've been listening to this podcast pretty much since it began, I think, when I was still a lowly student. And I don't think this is a topic that's been covered a lot in podcasts, because I know that emails aren't really Paul's favourite thing, and they do come under a lot of slack. They're seen as difficult to work with, outdated, they can be seen as spam. But research by VentureBeat has shown that for the last 10 years in a row now, email marketing has been the channel generating the highest return on investment for marketers. So they're obviously still a big player and don't seem to be going away anytime soon. So I thought I'd try and instill a bit of positivity about emails within the digital community. I remember there was an interview on the podcast a couple of years ago with Fabio Carnero, who's a bit of a celebrity of an email developer, and he advocates talking to the wider web community about email design rather than just preaching to the converted, so I thought I'd follow his lead a bit. So here we go. Here are my top 5 reasons to give email design and development a chance. Number 1, the email design community is amazing. I don't know if it's the whole underdog thing and because we feel like the inferior cousin to web design, we've got to come together and prove ourselves. But I found that people working with emails are really passionate about what they do and they want to keep learning, pushing the boundaries of what's possible. And even better, they want to help others do the same too. So you've got the Twitter hashtag campaign, Make Emails Great, which aims to do just that. And there are websites celebrating really good emails, such as reallygoodemails.com. For development support, you've got the Twitter hashtag emailgeeks, which is great, and that has a Slack channel now too. And there you get people sharing code, asking questions, or posting a cool or not so cool email they've seen. You've got email testing platforms like Email on Acid and Litmus, and they provide all sorts of tools and templates, as well as discussion forums, conferences, and even podcasts, if you like that kind of thing. And then there's even more targeted groups, like the hashtag Women of Email on Twitter, which I particularly like. There are more and more conferences popping up all the time for emails, like the Litmus Email Design Conference, which is brilliant, and the Email Innovation Summit. And these tend to be quite non-salesy, and just the people doing the hands-on work with emails every day, getting together, sharing their knowledge and ideas. So you learn a lot at these events and always come away feeling quite inspired and more like you've made a new bunch of mates, really. So again, these are always backed up with really active Twitter hashtags, so they create a lot of discussion during and after the events. So it's a really supportive and collaborative community. Reason number two, limits can be liberating. So sure, we may need to use old school tables and work with email clients that don't support all the latest cool CSS stuff, but having to keep things simpler and working within restrictions can actually breed more creativity because it encourages you to explore what else you can do within that space. And then actually when you do achieve something great within that space, it's all the more rewarding and it makes you want to share it and show it off. And there are some really talented people working within this field and pushing it forward all the time. To name drop one, an email developer called Mark Robbins has done amazing things in terms of interactive emails. And he often demos his more experimental work at conferences. And at one talk I saw him do, he revealed at the end that this whole slide deck that he'd been presenting through was actually an email. So he'd been clicking through different slides, it'd been animating all the way, showing different content. And yeah, it wasn't a PowerPoint deck or anything, it was actually all held within an email that he'd coded. So this brought on an audible gasp from the crowd, and I have to say after that he was a bit of a rock star at this conference. But yeah, he's pioneered things like shopping cart experiences and pagination within emails, so it is actually possible that emails can become a place to stick around, to interact with, to have an experience in, rather than just being a launch pad to click away off to another website or somewhere else. Bandwidth is improving all the time, so this has allowed for things like animated GIFs, nice big images, and email clients are improving too. They're offering greater CSS support now, so you can include things like CSS animations, hover states, background images, and you can do a lot more with your layouts and how they respond and adapt to different widths and devices. As long as you work in fallbacks for the clients that don't support things, then there's nothing really to stop you doing interesting things in the ones that do. As with anything, of course, it's worth knowing your audience and the environments that they tend to be in to double-check how relevant this sort of stuff is going to be for them. Also, Litmus, who I previously mentioned, have teamed up with Microsoft, I think last year, in an effort to help improve the rather awkward Outlook clients. So they're giving email developers a voice and working with Microsoft to report all the bugs and the things that make developers' lives hard in hope to improve the rendering of emails in Outlook. So things are really looking up there and just generally come a really long way. I think it's a really exciting time to be working with emails. Number three, email is a really personal and effective marketing channel. So in 2015, Marketing Sherpa reported that 72% of US consumers named emails as their favoured method of receiving communication from the companies that they deal with. So that's a good stat for you, and just shows there's a fantastic opportunity there to develop a really strong relationship with your email subscribers. In fact, more and more companies are sending from a reply to address rather than a do not reply address, as they recognise this is a great place for a conversation and dialogue, and it shouldn't just be a broadcast. You can get really personal with people, and I mean more than just having dear first name in your emails. For instance, I've seen examples of emails that will dynamically check the weather in the recipient's location and then display different content accordingly. I also know a lot of people say that they've got a favourite email that they know comes in every week and they'll wait with anticipation to have a good read of it. So if your content is engaging and strikes a chord with people, you can build great loyalty. Of course, all this comes with great responsibility as well, so you have to respect that you're entering their personal space and be careful not to bombard people or be too salesy. If you keep your emails helpful and interesting, then they can be a really valuable form of communication. Number four, instant feedback and real-time results. So whilst it's quite scary that once an email is gone, it's gone, and there's not much you can do about it, which is why testing is so key here, there are advantages to having a form of communication that you know reaches your audience at a certain time. A-B split tests being one. So for instance, you can take a portion of your audience, split them in half, and send the same email to each, but with different subject lines. The open rates can then be tracked instantly by your automation program, and the most successful one can be sent to the remaining portion of your audience right then. So it's fast, it's automated, and you can see the results real time as the emails are delivered. You could also test different designs and content in your emails and then track how these affect the click-through rates. So because you're able to measure and track the results of an email so soon after it's sent, it's really useful because it means you can take that data and learnings and inform the next send and just keep improving your output all the time. Automation platforms are really powerful these days in terms of what they can do. There are so many out there now as well, aimed at all different levels. So perhaps a smaller business might use something like MailChimp, and a large corporate would use Eloqua. Either way, the tools are getting increasingly more helpful. They'll often provide responsive templates and drag and drop features. But for more advanced users, you can do all sorts of cool things with data as well, such as segmenting your contacts into different target groups, sending different things based on recipients' activities, setting up rules for different languages and time zones, and working in Logic to send a series of emails for a nurture track. So really, the possibilities are endless. Finally, number five, emails are just the start. More often than not, if you're working with emails, they are just the tip of the iceberg. They're probably part of a larger campaign or a marketing effort that involves websites, social channels, events. So your emails can bring all this together and link off to landing pages, surveys, microsites, and social campaigns. They can tie in with events that are running and bring in the graphics used in those. My point being really that you can still flex your web and your print design muscles and create cool stuff that your emails can link to as part of a wider campaign. And that's why working with emails never gets boring. So that's it really. I hope I've succeeded somewhat in dispelling some of the negativity around designing and developing emails, and perhaps encouraged some of you to take another look at it. I, for one, love working with emails, and I know a lot of people that do. Thanks for listening.
So there we go.
Beep.
That was an annoying beep, isn't it? To put over Paul at that point. Lee's what? Just got no podcast etiquette.
I haven't. I'm sorry, Paul. I beeped you out. But you probably couldn't hear me beeping you out.
No,
I was inserting a handy beep so Marcus could see it on the timeline.
It's okay. I can see it anyway. Okay. Because he'd leave a little gap.
Thank you for your help.
Do you think
help,
we can carry on now?
I don't know.
Such a good idea getting Lee on, wasn't it?
It was bloody terrible. The show's going to be way too long. I'm going to get in trouble with my wife, who, by the way, you know, we did the
whole thing. Yeah. The end of the one a couple of weeks ago.
She loved it.
What was that long word again?
It's no point of saying it, right? She basically said to me, is that the best we can do?
Ooh. Some German, maybe.
German, that's a good idea. Well, I just thought, I mean, you go with some really long, complicated, techie phrases that she doesn't even know how to start writing. You know, if we talk about, especially some of the made-up services that are around here, you know, these days. What are some of the jQuery libraries and, you know, where they've all got stupid names? That would be a good way to go.
I don't know. yeah, I hear them, but they just whoosh over my head and then they're forgotten about forever.
Anyway, we're supposed to be talking about Laura's talk.
Yes, move on. So, designing emails.
So, Lee, did you actually listen to this?
I did, yes.
Because I have to say, I think this is where your calling is. You never really wanted to move on to CSS-based design, did you, really?
Well, you say that.
That's a bit mean, isn't it, Paul?
Well, come on, let's face it. CSS makes no sense whatsoever. How many years have I been doing it for? It's just full of quirks and stupid things that break and whatever you do. Not that table design was much easier. But no, in fact, yeah, I mean, email is that last bastion of table layout, isn't it? And when I've had to do that in recent years, I've ended up just having to go with MailChimp or using their templates.
Yeah.
I think it's all of the testing that's been done on those templates that hasn't been done on my kind of new code, my new table layout, tested in two browsers, two email clients.
So just going, why is email still tables? Is it because of just Outlook?
It's a good question.
Or is it, you know, do some email clients support CSS and others don't?
Yeah, it's not actually just tables these days. You can do, well, I mean, as you heard from Laura's talk, you can do some quite amazing stuff now in email. In fact, you know, the idea that you could do things like interactivity just blew my mind.
I didn't realise that.
No, neither did I. But from what I understand it, a lot of the holdback that email is experiencing, some of it is because, you know, like Outlook is built on Word or whatever. I don't know whether it is anymore, but last time I checked it was. I haven't touched this for years, to be honest. But also there are a lot of stuff is stripped out by the or overridden by the email client for security reasons and you know, various other things, because you wouldn't want JavaScript running, you know, so that as soon as you click on an email you could run blooming anything, couldn't you, you know. So there are certain sensible constraints there as well, but a lot of it is that there's just so many different email clients, all built on different systems, and the result is chaos. They need they need the equivalent of a web standards group for email. And I know that that kind of thing has happened in the past, but never really quite caught on in the same way as it did with you know, the web. So, but actually I was a bit sad in a way. I think Laura misunderstood me a lot. Well, no, she didn't misunderstand
me. Like everyone, Paul.
I must misunderstood. It's the
you
story
are misunderstood.
Of, it's the story of my life. No, she had the impression that I was very anti-email. And there was a stage. I did go through an anti-email stage. I don't really know what my justification for that was. Just because I felt that there was too much email in the world. And I still feel like that. But no, I've come round to email. I think it's an important part of your kind of digital marketing mix, really. And even for me, my newsletter, my email newsletter that I send out, is probably the most powerful tool I have, or certainly one of them, in terms of reaching my audience. So
that's what she said, wasn't it? She said it, you know, that's email generally, it is the most powerful marketing tool. I mean, you know, we've talked about what somebody did a talk on writing nice emails, didn't they? I can't remember who that was.
And I thought about Paul when I heard that one.
And it just, because it's not just about marketing. We as human beings, not all of us, but a lot of us use email all the time. So I think it's really important. So I think it should, you know, it shouldn't be the, you know, the poor brother or whatever the right comparison is to browsers. It should be a, you know, There needs to be another committee like the Web Standards Group, definitely. I was surprised, sorry, Paul. I didn't realise that there was this huge active community in email design.
No, I had no clue.
I've always assumed it's web developers who don't want to do it. That's who do email design. And it's like, wow, there's a whole community of people who do this. I didn't know.
And conferences and everything. Yeah. That just went completely over my head. I couldn't believe it. So there you go.
That's a start, though, isn't it? So maybe if there's this huge, you know, if there is a big community in conferences, etc., maybe there is a light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, it's got to get better. When you're putting stuff into you're feeding it directly into people's brains, then, you know, there's an area to be explored there and to be made better. Definitely.
Is that how you see email? Someone emails you, it goes directly into your brain.
Well, it's coming to you. Well, you're not going out to get it. It's kind of coming into your life, isn't it? And I think most people just have too many emails coming into their life, which is why a lot of people feel oversaturated by them. You just have to go through and sort of pare out anything that's just getting in the way.
Unsubscribe.
Yeah, I go through mad fits of unsubscribing. Yeah. And those that are left are emails I actually want to get and want to read. And they're still trying to sell me things.
Yeah,
but I chose to have that.
World guitars and yes. things like that.
They're actually quite exciting.
Ooh, shiny.
Deal of the week.
Yeah.
If it was deal of the day, it might get a bit annoying. So I think, yeah, the repetition is, you know, the timing is important.
Yeah. Yeah, it is very much so. The other thing that I think is really important, which Laura touched on, was this idea of you need to be able to reply. You know, instead of having no reply email addresses. Mm. That's one of the things that I love most about. And that why I so like my newsletter is because I can actually have an interaction with people. I can talk to people and they write back to me. And it's really lovely. I love that back and forth that we get every time I send my email out.
Sorry,
so we can annoy you now, Paul.
Yeah.
When the email comes in. Hi.
I didn't know you could reply to that. That's really clever.
Yeah, did you not know you could reply to me?
I think I've just now assumed you can't reply to any newsletters ever.
Yeah, no, I actively...
How do you know?
How much you've ever read my emails, because I always say...
Do you say it? Oh, right. Probably never got that far.
But you see, the other thing that I really like about them is it's actually... you know, if I compare it to the conversion rate of something like a social media update, it's so much higher. You know, I send out a social media update to, 42,000 people that follow me on Twitter, and I get less response to that than I get to sending an email out to 7,000 people. So it's incredibly high. And also, of course, the quality of the interaction that you can have is much higher. You can be a lot more in depth. You can, you know, have a much more interesting conversation. So, yeah, you can tell I've come to hate social media and I've replaced it with email.
Are you being polite on your email now, Paul? You know, saying, hello, how are you today?
I am.
Like that. Thanks very much. Goodbye, Paul. Not just a one-liner with no intro and no kind of outro.
Well, I'm still very torn over this. I have tried to be more of a human being, but it doesn't come naturally, if I'm honest. And I also, the trouble is you want to write what you want to receive, don't you? And for me, I don't give a shit. When people say, how are you? They don't mean it. They don't want me to reply how I am.
I'm feeling a bit depressed today.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's just part of being polite, isn't it? It's part of our culture.
It's stupid.
When you get a one word reply from an email, it's just like, yes.
There's a difference, isn't there? If you write how are you, then that's just asking for trouble in that people won't believe.
You'd say it the other way around. Hope you are well. Yeah,
there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah,
see,
I agree.
There's a way to do it, Paul.
But my mum told me not to lie, and I don't give a shit one way or another whether they're well, as long as they give me what I want.
You do, because if they're not well and they're dead, they won't be able to buy your book, Paul. That's why you need to care.
I need to care whether they're well or not, because otherwise they won't be able to do whatever it is I want them to do
exactly.
in the email.
You're bidding.
I finally get it, Lee. Thank
you.
Yeah,
okay. Just need framing in a certain way, didn't it?
Yeah.
A monetary way.
Such a low opinion of me. Anyway. By the way, dear listener, if you email me, I'm not the horrible, evil person that Marcus and Lee are making me out to be.
Lovely, Paul.
You were you didn't give a shit about people, Paul.
Yeah, but they know that I was
joking. They know you're joking. It's all a big joke, isn't it?
Yeah.
All a big joke.
Life is a big joke. Right, so that's Laura. Have we got anything else to say on Laura? I don't feel that we've really done her talk justice, and I blame Lee for that.
Sorry.
I think...
So do I.
I liked the idea of dynamically checking weather. I thought that was a good thing. I liked the idea that constraints encourages creativity. I absolutely agree with that. And I think we've covered everything else. So we did do better. It was just in a very rambling way. So there we go.
As usual. Even more rambling than usual.
Yeah. Let's talk about FreshBooks and then we can move on to the shitty second talk we've got.
Oh, no, not that one.
It's just embarrassing that we've got
scraping the barrel now.
Oh, it really is, really is. Right, it's nearly the end of season, you see. Yeah. Although Laura, actually, I think hers was one of the early ones and I managed to get them out of order. Not that yeah. I mean, see, now I've just dug a hole because the implication
yes,
is...
Yes, you have.
All the talks...
So really, really awful ones next week then, Paul.
It's that ordering again, I should think.
Look what you've done.
It's not even true. I just talk.
I said scraping.
Just
the
words come out of my mouth. I'm not responsible for them. This is why the sponsored sections I've written down to stop me kind of getting too off track. So yes, FreshBooks is a really easy tool for creating and sending invoices. It's really straightforward. You can send an invoice in about 30 seconds. And you can obviously customize it with your own logo, your colors, all of that kind of stuff. Your clients can pay online, which can seriously improve, how quickly you get paid, fairly obviously. And it also, you can see how your clients are interacting with your invoice and whether they've opened the email that you've sent with the invoice and whether they've viewed the invoice itself and all the rest of it. And FreshBooks can also send late payment reminders, which is really great because you can send a snotty email and then blame FreshBooks for sending it automatically. And, oh, yes, you shouldn't have received that. You know, that's far too pushy for your situation, but actually you meant every word of it. You can also use FreshBooks deposit feature, which is really good for taking deposits up front. Now, I have a confession to make, which is that I don't actually use FreshBooks because I use a UK-centric tool. Although FreshBooks works perfectly well with the UK, you know what it's like. You get stuck in a certain way of doing things. And this tool that I use doesn't offer the ability to do deposits. And it's really irritating. So I love the fact that FreshBooks does this. And when I actually find some time, I might seriously look at moving because that drives me bloody round the twist. It really does. Because it's always good to get deposits if you possibly can. FreshBooks also you need to try it for yourself. You know how these things are. So they've offered a month of unrestricted use to everybody who's listening to the show. You've no need for a credit card or anything like that. All you need to do is go to freshbooks.com/BoagWorld. And if you do us a favor that when you sign up, you enter Boag World UX Show in the How Did You Hear About Us section, then we get credit for it. So I really appreciate them supporting the show, finding and all of the people that have sponsored the show this season, because finding sponsors is an absolute blooming pain in the ass. But it does help cover the costs of running the show and all the rest of it. And paying these really expensive speakers that we have that we don't pay at all. People like our next speaker, who is some bloke. Like Lee, you can justify, because it's Lee that's speaking next. If you I'm not being rude about random people. I'm only being rude about Lee. Lee, why does your bio say the son of a sculptor and toy designer? I mean, is that really the kind of thing that we need to know about you?
Definitely. It's really, really quite crucial to my being.
And how does being the son of a sculptor and toy designer influence your design process?
Well, I think it's seeing things as a bigger picture rather than just web design, you know, a design led from all different aspects. I'm hitting the microphone. Where does it say that anyway? On my website?
On your website, yeah.
Oh, right. Oh, that hasn't been updated for years. I have no idea. Oh, I think it was going to link to their websites. That's why. It was going to link to each of their websites.
Right. And it doesn't. So that worked well then.
I probably haven't finished their websites, to be honest.
You haven't finished their websites. You haven't updated yours in ages. And you're now expecting the listener to take you seriously.
That's because we work so hard at Headscape.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
He's just so busy working on high-flying client work.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no go time on. For me.
Lee, name some cool clients that you've worked on.
Cool.
Oh, I couldn't divulge that kind of information. All the really cool
They're
stuff.
They're too secret.
Top secret, yeah.
You had to sign NDAs.
Absolutely. Yeah. Can't tell the likes of you.
That's a fair comment, Lee. I can't argue with that. So, So although the last time, so Lee was on last week and he was talking about recording videos for, you know, to show off design. And pretty much he pretty much claimed that that was his idea, which it blatantly wasn't. It was blatantly really? My idea that he then ripped off massively. But this week, what he's suggesting is actually his idea. He did come up with it. And although it pains me deeply, it is a really good idea. And it's the idea of using, getting clients designing a reception area in order to establish some of the kind of direction of your design. So let's hear what Lee has got to say on this one. And yeah, and so it over to Lee.
So I've been designing for the web for nearly 25 years now and working as a designer with Headscape since it was founded in 2001. In the early days of project kickoff meetings, I remember really quite low-key events, you know, maybe a couple of hours at best, sat around a table with one or two people from the client. With smaller companies, this was probably, you know, the top guy themselves, herself, and we sort of kicked around ideas in a very informal, casual sort of way. And I'm not really sure that design even got touched upon very often. Slowly, as the clients got bigger and kickoffs became bigger and loads of people suddenly started turning up, and you know, they had to be there, person from this department, that department, every man and his dog. To be honest, it started getting a bit nerve-wracking for someone like myself who isn't a natural speaker in front of an audience. And as these kickoffs and projects got bigger and longer, so did the accountability, of course, and the need to get things right as soon as possible. And slowly but surely, kickoff meetings transformed into workshops. Once something becomes a workshop, these are kind of these are different things, and expectations and requirements are different. And talking about design in a meeting format, people, loads of people around a table, doesn't really work so well. Well, we know the dominant voices tend to steamroller everything, but people need, you know, to look at things and reflect and, you know, think about things in smaller groups. Slowly but surely, there was more and more leaping up out of our chairs and sketching things on flip charts and whiteboards and, you know, putting yellow stickies everywhere. And greater attempts were made to kind of get everybody in the room more involved. So more formulated exercises were borrowed from others. One book that really springs to mind for me is Guerrilla UX by Kenneth Bowles, and we'll put a link to that somewhere in the notes for this. And that outlined some really good exercises to get groups into isolation, so yeah, they could air their ideas, and there's some great exercises in there that you can follow. So exercises like six-up design and cereal box, both in Kenneth's book, were added to much simpler ideas which we had originally, like, you know, if your organisation was a famous person, who would it be? Which invariably produced Stephen Fry, and in more recent years, Brian Cox. Every time, you can rely on them. Though these exercises were really good for helping to prioritise content and touch on layout ideas, we still didn't really have anything for helping to kind of extract ideas about look and feel or the mood of the website. How is it going to look? So there are three exercises we often do. You've probably heard about a couple of them, which are like collaborative group mood boarding and, you know, word pairs. But the main one I want to talk about here is an exercise I kind of invented, and I've never seen it anywhere else, and that's called the reception area exercise, or waiting room exercise. I invented this with a workshop looming on the horizon. It was designed to kind of extract thinking from people that don't necessarily know how to express what a website should look like. Whereas everyone knows, or at least thinks they know something about decorating a room, whether they've done it themselves in the past or not. Basically, it's a page of questions that anybody can answer to get their design thinking juices flowing. I wanted people to talk about design for their company or institution in a non-web related context. It has evolved a bit over time, started off about two sides of A4, but now it's single side of A4 with eight questions. So it starts off with a little description. You must design a reception waiting area for general visitors who know nothing about you, insert client name here optionally, or the work it does. The room is communicating the personality and the ethos of your company, creating an atmosphere subliminally instructing, influencing, and informing your visitor. So the first question is, what format or size would the room be? And then little helpful text. Tiny and personable, huge and intimidating. Does it have windows? Is there a view? So the idea here is to kind of see whether it would be a more personal space or whether it would be some grand room, which, you know, they're trying to make an impression with. So that can give a few kind of ideas about what they're hoping for. If it's a massive room full of space and light, maybe, you know, they're trying to impress people. So maybe that's one of their aims. So question two, how would the walls be treated? Painted, what colour, paper, what pattern, cork, tile, shells, other? So here's the first kind of hint at what kind of colours they associate with their organisation. Now, obviously, if their main brand colour is luminous yellow, they might not want to paint a reception area luminous yellow, but then again, they might. If it's a kind of young, hip, trendy company, maybe that's exactly what they would do to get that brand across. So this is just a little way of trying to start exploring what colours are important to them, and if they are so important, they want to put them everywhere. And also you might be able to tease out different ideas about patterns, textures, that kind of thing. So third question, what decoration would you have on the walls? Photography of what? Paintings of what? Abstract sculpture? Nothing? So again, this is trying to start to tease out some of the imagery that might be important to them. So if it's important in a reception room, then, you know, there'll be decisions and choices, reasons behind those choices, and we need to start exploring what they are. So if they're going to have photos of abstract puddles of oil or something, you want to know why, and kind of starting to work out, are these going to be appropriate for the site later on? Whereas if they don't have any photography, but abstracts are more appropriate for whatever they deal with in their organisation, that might be something that starts getting reflected in the site too. If they don't have anything at all, well, that could say heaps. Maybe imagery just isn't them, isn't necessary, and isn't part of the key messages or the key information they're trying to get across. So question four, would your logo be visible anywhere? Where? How big? And what style? So the idea here is just to sort of start teasing what they think about their brand identity and how important they think it is. We've all heard, make the logo bigger. So I'm trying to get to whether that is so important to them as an identification of who they are that they want their logo everywhere. Or whether, conversely, it's actually quite a subliminal thing that can be more muted and put in the background and isn't quite so important to them. So this is just a chance for me to start exploring how the people in the company, organisation, think about their own logo. Five, what furniture would you choose? Traditional, utilitarian, ultra-modern, big, small, soft lighting, office standard lighting? So here I'm trying to get to what they consider appropriate in terms of the design that goes into sort of furniture and lighting. So people have opinions on furniture and lighting and what that says about themselves in their own home. So I'm trying to apply that kind of same design thinking extraction here. You know, do they consider a leather Chesterfield as being what their organisation is all about, or maybe a hard glass edge steel table that might say something different? You know, is it softly lit from above with modern down lighting, or is it a kind of low lamp over a table? I'm just trying to get to what kind of general mood in terms of, you know, furniture design, lighting design that they consider is appropriate for them, and that can help, you know, influence how the design goes later on. Six, what might be on a table? Annual reports, magazines, general information, art books, or books on, and insert relevant thing for the client here, so something relevant to them. So in this one, I'm kind of trying to tease out whether they're more interested in information about themselves, presenting that to people waiting, or kind of, you know, general information about the sort of area that they deal with. So if they're a charity who deals with insects, do they just have general insect books on the table, or whether it's just information about them, or whether it's something completely off the wall, a book on art or something like that, just to relax people? Is that what's more important to them? Not sure this has had a massive influence on how design goes later, but it can be interesting to tease this kind of information out. Seven, in one word, what general atmosphere would you like to create? So I added this question fairly recently, and I just wanted to get to a single word, like airy or relaxing, just to kind of understand what they were trying to get at in all of the above questions, And that can be a useful word to help guide how we deal with the general mood when we do mood boards as a next step. So when I do this exercise, I tend to work with pairs, give this sheet to pairs or groups of three or four, if there's a lot of people, give them about 15, 20 minutes. I also say on the back they can sketch the room if they want to. That's more of a time filler than anything else if they finish quickly. Not something I really find useful looking at the sketches, but it can be nice to keep people busy for a little minute whilst people are finishing the exercise off. Whatever you do, don't do this per person. I did this once. I gave a room of like 15 people. I had enough sheets, so I thought, oh, I'll give everybody one. However, the room went completely silent and everyone did it like a test and it was really awkward. So that was quite horrible. Don't do that again, Lee. So I wouldn't recommend giving individuals workshop exercises ever, really, because it just doesn't create the right atmosphere. So reporting back what they've done, sometimes I've just let people kind of read out their sheets per group and write down key words, so you can kind of tally up on a flip chart or whiteboard when the same words come over and over again. And then that adds up to be a kind of priority keyword list in the end. It's also really useful to share what they've done on a screen. So I've done that more and more lately. Evernote, or I think Apple Photos does the same. Evernote's camera function is really good. It grabs the page instantly, resizes it, crops it, and auto-contrasts it. And it synchronizes it up to my laptop version of Evernote. So I use my camera or tablet. Take the pictures quickly after I've grabbed the sheets from people, and within a minute or two they're up on the projector, so that can be really nice to review back. It's nice for the person reviewing back, giving the information back to the group as well, because the focus tends to be on the screen rather than them. So if they're not as confident, all eyes aren't on them, which can be a bit intimidating in a big group. So these exercises are great when you follow up later when you present your design and wireframe work, etc. You can kind of interject the outputs of these exercises, because each of these has some kind of visible output that you can then insert into presentations or videos, and it helps support the ideas and how you got to where you got to in the design, rather than you just sat there alone and plucked it out of thin air in a creative moment of genius. Before I worked in web design, I'd got sent to a few conferences and things as part of my first job, and there were workshops, and I can't say I really enjoyed them. They really seemed a bit contrived, and you'd sit around in a circle and have to talk about yourselves, and I really didn't like that. But actually, in the web, they've got a lot more fun, as there is actually activities that I enjoy doing. So even though I'm not experienced at giving workshops, or I've got no background in teaching, it can be daunting when you're actually responsible for sessions in a workshop. But when you've got well-structured activities, timing and techniques, then that's the secret, really. It helps you actually structure the session and keep things rolling along. And I've learned they actually can be fun and you get useful results. You'll be dealing with grown-ups, not a bunch of school children, who I'm sure are a lot more terrifying to deal with. So try and get what you can from people in the kickoff meeting. It's probably one of the few times you're going to meet them. And somewhere between their combined brains is the design. You just need to extract it from them.
Before we go any further.
Right, okay.
There was a couple of mistakes at the start of that little talk, Lee, that I need to pull you up on. Main one being Headscape didn't start in 2001.
Could have sworn it did. Are you sure I haven't been working for Headscape since 2001?
2002.
Oh, feels like 2001 to me.
Also, the book Undercover UX Design, mm-hmm. Nothing to do with guerrillas.
I think Guerrilla would have been a much better title for it.
Was written by Kenneth Bowles and James Box.
Old James.
He always gets forgotten, doesn't he?
It's that in-depth research I did. That'll be it.
But other than that, marvellous talk, Lee. Fantastic as ever. Based on sort of all your Headscape experience. Wonderful.
Lee, you with the reception room, you kept talking about the questions you've got on a worksheet. Do you still have that worksheet?
Because I gave you a link to it.
Because it'd be good to include in the show notes.
I sent you a link.
Oh, did you? Oh, I don't ever read what you write. Okay, so...
And he's the same with everyone that sends anything to him.
So, Catherine, my wife I'm talking to now, who's transcribing this show, make sure you get the link from me to the reception room exercise, because actually it's quite a good fact sheet that Lee uses. I've got to say, Lee, this is a really good exercise. How the hell did you come up with it? Because it works so well.
I think it was desperation, because I knew I had to do a slot in a workshop, and I wanted some other design exercise, which, well, as I said in the talk, kind of covered design, but not from a web design point of view.
Mm. Yeah, I can remember exactly when it was, and I think I told you, Lee, this is your slot for the next hour, probably 2 weeks in advance. It was when we worked for Dickstein. 5 years ago, something like that.
Yeah, it was. And I think I went through a few ideas, like designing a car and various other things. But none of those really were something that everybody has, you know, everybody has a waiting room or a reception room in their company. And, you know, it reflects the company you are. You know, what do you do with it? You know, even if, like most people, very little. You could imagine what you might do to reflect your brand.
Yeah, we've done these loads of these over the years since, and what I've found is obviously everybody says they want a nice, bright, airy space.
Yes.
So it's the surprises. It's the things you're not expecting people to say that are the most useful things that come out of it. Because you know everybody's working to some kind of style guide that they've got a load of words that you need to kind of think about. Maybe putting mood boards together around the words that they associate with their brand. But you might get another one or two that come out of this reception area that nobody's thought of before. And that's fantastic. That's when they really work well.
And also, I'm not sure, a lot of style guides don't contain a list of words. You know, they just go, here's the colour palette, here's the logo. And for me, what I love about these, you know, this exercise is that, you know, people are talking about what's going on, you know, what pictures are going on the wall or whatever. And they say, you know, we want something colourful and, you know, dynamic and, well, colourful, dynamic. Those, you know, and you can test against those words later as well, you know.
Yep.
Which is so useful. And most importantly, and this is the bit that's really useful, is when you present the design, going back to Lee's previous week, you can say, you know, some of the words that came out of the reception room exercise that you completed, the words you selected, you know, were da 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 da, and you can see how I've used those in the design. So it makes the client and stakeholders feel like it's their design, and so therefore they're less likely to reject it. It's just genius. It really is.
Genius.
Yeah,
you don't hear that every day, do you?
Not from me, you don't.
Never heard that, no.
Have I never encouraged you, Lee?
Oh, come on, Paul. You got me started in web design.
Oh, we're going to get all nostalgic now.
I've got so much to thank you for. Nah, so you encourage me tons, Paul.
Do you know, that's the really funny bit. I get that a lot. Right, you know, you know, I'm at some conference or other. Have I said this on the podcast? I can't remember whether I said it on the podcast. I was recently at a conference and I was sitting next to another one of the speakers. And he leant over to me and said, you know what? I am so chuffed to be sitting by you. Now, this all sounds like it's going great and it's going to make me sound great. He said, you have been a real inspiration to me, Paul. I got into web design because of you. I used to listen to your podcast on the way to school. It was going so well until that last line, and it's like, oh, great, thanks, great.
Yeah, and just so, have to accept it, Paul. Just look in the mirror, and that'll remind you that you're middle-aged.
It's also the fact that, you know, he's now my equal. He's my peer. Do you know what I mean? We're both speaking at the same conference, and, you know, And he's like half my age. What have I been doing in my life, Marcus? Where's it all gone?
I don't know, but in motorhomes and things.
That's true. Which is, I'm quite okay with that now I think about it. So that's good. So, okay, that's Lee's talk. Have we got anything else to say other than it's good?
There was one thing that you said at the end. I thought, well, that really is it summarizes why we do all this research stuff, which was, you said, extracting the designs from their combined brains, which I thought, yes, that's it.
That's how I now see kickoffs. You know, yeah. It's all in here. These people have got it in their brains in this room. Get it out of them before you leave. Otherwise, it's going to be a long, protracted process.
Yeah.
So and do it now.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Yeah. I really like that.
Did I say in the talk, I can't remember, about just warming people up about talking about design as well? So I think it's a good kind of warm-up exercise. Even if you get nothing from it, they start talking about design.
I'm thinking
using
about
words.
Yeah.
Even if all the other exercises that follow, you know, are more precise about content, everything else.
Yeah. That's actually the last point I would make on it is it's a really good starting point.
Yeah.
All the other stuff is much more kind of, yeah, precise, and you're getting more into detail. But this is just of a general, yeah, warming people's brains up. That's a good way to describe it.
Cool. All right then, Marcus, do you want to finish us off with a joke?
It's one for you, Paul. This is a joke for you.
Okay.
You won't like it, but insomnia is awful. But on the plus side, only 3 more sleeps till Christmas.
Oh, God.
That's a good one, isn't it? That's Adrian White. Thank you, Adrian.
Yeah, that's not funny when you live with it. But yes, it is funny. Okay, right. That's it for this week's show. Lee, thank you for coming and joining us. And obviously you, Marcus. You know, I don't want you to feel left out.
I don't at all.
Good.
More the merrier.
Good. All right, then. So back next week for the last show in the season.
Yeah.
We've got 3 talks to fit in order to finish off the season. So it's been a good one. And thank you, everybody who's contributed to the show over the
season.
You've
saved the best till last, though, right?
I didn't hear that.
You've saved the best till last, apparently.
Yes, definitely. The people next week are the best we've had on this season. Thank you. Tune in next week for the best. Nothing is better than what we cover next week. So tune in, everybody. Bye-bye.
Stop now, Paul.
Oh,